Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Today's episode is going to be, well, I say today's episode, this is actually the second episode I've recorded today, but I'll put it out a bit later. So this episode is about a book which is a quite recent book, an award-winning book. It's called Among Others by Joe Walton, and it says here on Wikipedia, published in 2011, and it won the 2012 Nebula Award for Best Novel, and the Hugo Award for Best Novel, and the British Fantasy Award. So there's a very, very award-winning kind of book, and it was a nominee for the World Fantasy Award for Best Novel, so a very highly thought-of book. And you may see a theme coming along after the last book that I reviewed, which is I was looking back... when I was looking through a list of books which have won both the Hugo and the Nebula, and I was just looking for inspiration of some audiobooks to download to use up some credits with Audible, and I was looking through this list and I thought, oh, here is another book which has won both of them, which I have not read. There's not many of the dual winners which I've not read of winning the Hugo and Nebula, the most prestigious awards in science fiction and fantasy. Well, I guess this is a fantasy book. It was nominated for a World Fantasy Award, so I'll guess it's a fantasy book too. So, I didn't know very much about this book. Of course, there was some, some discussion about it a few years ago when it came out, and of course, when it won the Hugo and Nebula Awards, there was discussions about it. And all I'd really heard, there was some magic realism, some fairies or something, and there was lots and lots of mentions of science fiction from the 1960s and 1970s. And around that time, people have said, oh, here's a list of all, I remember seeing on Goodreads, here's a list of all of the books that are mentioned in this book, or how about this, and check this out, and it's lots of books, great, and it won the award, so how bad could it be? So I thought, I'll get it. So I started listening to it, and it's a really good audiobook narrator. I will look up the name. So it's written by Joel Walton, narrated by Catherine Kellgren, and there was only one thing that I recognize her name from, and that's The Alchemist and the Executionist by Paolo Bacigalupi and Tobias Espacher, which I reviewed and really, really rated highly. And that was those were two novellas put together into a single novel style book, narrated by Jonathan Davis, who was one of my favorite narrators, and Catherine Kellgren. This was put together or written for Audible, commissioned by Audible, so they got their good narrators in there. So Catherine Kellgren is playing the part of a 15-year-old Welsh girl called Moena Phillips, or Moore Phillips, or Maury, I think her name is. Yeah, Maury is what she calls herself. And Maury is Welsh, and Catherine Kellgren has a very, very good Welsh accent. And there's all the way through the book, you can see that as she's being surrounded by other people without Welsh accents and with sort of more upper-class accents and middle-class accents, then her accent changes, and she even mentions that throughout. And it's a very, very good reading, amazing accents and things like that. So I just want to put that out there first because... the next good thing that I started when I read it, I should actually stick to my notes here, is that it starts really, really great. It tells of a good story, a cool story of these twins, Maury and Morgan, I think is her twin sister, and they run along, and there's this big factory that's polluting, and they say the fairies have asked them to put some flowers in the middle of the factory, and it's gonna shut down, or the factory is gonna be destroyed, or it's gonna be out of the way because the pollution is too bad, and they want to get rid of it. And so they do this, and they go through the wire and the cable, and they run across and some action, and they run and they put the stuff down, and then they run out, and then the next day the factory closes, and it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. So it worked. It wasn't working in the way that she was expecting the magic to work, but the magic did work, and I thought, this is actually quite clever, quite some fun, clever magic, in that the fairies influence the world, but it looks like that it looks like they haven't been influencing the world, or, you know, it isn't just poof and everything happens. It's kind of happens in a way which could be natural. It reminds me of the gun in the A&M Banks book, Against a Dark Background, where you point the gun at someone and press fire and something will happen to destroy that thing, you know, like they'll fall over and break their leg. If you point at a human, they'll fall over and break their leg and kill themselves or break the neck. Or if you point at a city and you pull the trigger, a meteor will come and just smash it up, you know, that kind of thing. So it's like using the natural world or naturalism to fulfill magical powers in a way. So I thought that was going to be the go, and then there's a passage which says, this isn't how the story starts, though. This happens part of the way through my story. And then there's a passage which says, this involves fairies, and maybe you don't believe in fairies, so feel free to believe that magic exists, or feel free to not believe that magic exists. I'm going to tell my story, and it's up to you to decide, but I believe that fairies exist. And now let's get into the story. And I thought, this is great. This is really cool. It's going to be a fun exploration of, you know, these fairies and these twins and things like that. And then it just becomes, I say just, then it becomes a journal of Maury, a 15-year-old Welsh girl who has run away from her mother and who is a twin. But we find out quite early on that her twin has died. And then she goes to a boarding school and she has to just spend time at a boarding school. That's what the book is about. And then suddenly, like, well, I say suddenly, but slowly, it dawned on me that there should be so much stuff right about this book that will fit for me. For example, she's a twin, and it talks about her being a twin, like when she no longer had a twin anymore. So it was like, oh, and then I was being greeted as a person rather than half of a pair of people. And as someone who has an identical twin, who grew up with a twin, and then sort of like when we both left school or both left college, you know, I suddenly had a life, and so many times before that, I would always been addressed as half a pair of people, and now I was a single person. And when people didn't realize I had a twin, they treated me different to when they realized I did have a twin. And I actually have quite a lot in common with this 15-year-old girl. Oh, 15-year-old Luke had quite a lot in common with 15-year-old Maury. She was like, oh, I'm good at these other subjects. Although she's amazing at all these subjects, but she's like, I'm good at subjects, but maths doesn't really sit well with me. I can do some maths, which work really well. I can do all this stuff with algebra, but then long division doesn't sit in my brain. And the maths class is like, hey, what, like, or the teacher is like, well, why, how can you do this? And you can't just do simple long division. And it reminds me of my schooling where I never even today, I don't know how to do long division. If you put a long division, it's not like I'm not very good at it or I make mistakes. I just don't know, like, the physical things of, like, not the physical, but like looking, like conceptually, I don't know what happens with long division. I have calculators. I don't need to do that kind of stuff. But it is really difficult for me. And I have that same kind of brain. And she's in a boarding school. I didn't go to boarding school. But I, you know, I worked at a boarding school in a kitchen, in a school kitchen. I was a dinner lady for a year after I left college and before going to university. In my year out, I worked in a boarding school. So I've kind of seen that kind of stuff from the inside out, not as a pupil, but some of that kind of stuff. And yeah, and there's lots of mentions of the science fiction and things. And I was a big science fiction reader, and she's a big science fiction reader. She talks about how she clears out the whole library. You know, she reads every science fiction book in the town library. And I also did that. I read every single science fiction book in the town library and in the school library and all that kind of thing. I've been there. I've done that kind of stuff. And so I was thinking, this should be for me. This should be all like in my wheelhouse, as they say. But my next note, you know, I'd made some of these notes like, oh, long division doesn't sit my brain, being greeted as a person rather than half a pair of people. And then my next note is this, much later, why the fuck am I listening to what filling is in sandwiches at high tea? And that's a really good question. Why was I, like, because I realized that there was just, like, hours later, hours of listening to this audiobook later, I'm just like, this is really boring. This is really, really tedious. It gets to the point where just time and time again, she's saying, oh, and then I had this bun and I bought a bun for this person and I had this hot bun and it was very nice. And then this person had a bun for me and that's it. And then we went here and the food was like this and this food and I want to cook the food, but I'm not allowed to cook the food. And so when there's another time I want food, but I'm not allowed to cook the food. And what is this about food? And then what is in the fillings? It's not like there was different fillings in the sandwiches. It was like, and this sandwich had cucumbers and ham in it. And this sandwich had some tomato and beans. And this sandwich had some peanut butter and this. And it was high tea. And the definition of high tea is when it's not just afternoon tea. Afternoon tea is when tea doesn't have any hot stuff in, and then if you have hot stuff in the afternoon tea, it becomes high tea if there's any hot food into it. And I had this and the food wasn't very good. And I'm just like, oh, it's just tedious. And this isn't just once or twice. It just goes on and on and on. It's like the most important thing in the book is who she is buying current buns for, who she is buying buns, because she's not allowed to buy. Here we go again. I'm not allowed to buy a bun for myself. I have to buy a bun for me and somebody else. The way that it works is the popular girls always have buns bought for them because someone has to buy a bun for themselves and somebody else, and they get all the buns. But then I'm not very popular and I don't get the buns, but then I'm going to buy a bun, and then this person isn't allowed to buy buns because she's Jewish and we only get to buy buns on a Saturday, and then I do this, and then it's just boring. Just boring. Like, I'm not a 15-year-old girl, and I never have been, but, like, why? What is happening in her life which is so interesting? Like, why should I be finding all of this stuff really boring? She even makes a note at one point. I made a note of this as well. The aunts, she's got these three aunts who are all in the 40s, I think the triplets or something. And they went to the same school, and they're like, oh, then she comes home and says, oh, tell me about the school. Tell us all about the school. They're saying, and it says, the aunts found school amazingly interesting, even though they're aged 40. And I'm like, well, I'm 33 years old. Maybe I'm also too old to be finding the school amazingly interesting. Like, she's complaining that her aunts are finding what happens at her school really interesting, but then she is writing, like, her journal out. I mean, I'm listening to it as an audiobook. Hours and hours are going by and nothing is happening. It's really boring. Now, I don't want to make it out like, oh, I've interrupted this before. Like, I'm not a 15-year-old girl and I've never have been. So I'm not saying that the life of a 15-year-old girl is boring, but the way it's written is really boring. It's this flat telling of, like, in a journal, but it's never like, oh, I'm very excited to do this. I'll come back to you and say what happened. And then the next journal entry starts. Oh, you never believe it. It's fantastic. I want to do this. Yeah, this is so good. I can hardly control my pen. I need to write it. There's lots of tricks to make journals sound more interesting, but it's like, say, a flat telling. It's like, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. I've done that, I've done that, I've done that, I've done that. Next, I did this, I did this. And it's just a very inelegant and unartful writing of a journal. And like I say, the writing is very boring. The conversations are sometimes laid out very boring. It's like, how do I believe that she wrote out all of these conversations long form? You know, does anybody really do that in journals? Maybe they do, but, like, then how do you remember it all? You know, all that kind of stuff. But I don't want to say that, like, it's because it's a 15-year-old girl perspective is why I don't like it, because, like, I'm sure there's lots of books where a 15-year-old girl perspective is actually fascinating, is actually interesting. Like, for example, there's a mix of food and dresses and relationships and kids killing each other in The Hunger Games. And suddenly the 15-year-old girl perspective, or 16-year-old girl, or however old Katniss is in The Hunger Games, I actually really enjoyed that. It's a refreshing point of view. I think one of the geniuses of that book is mixing in the dresses and the food and the relationships and the love triangle and all of those other things with the kids killing each other, because if it was just kids killing each other, it would be really grim. And, like, that it's filtered through, like, these amazing circumstances are filtered through 15-year-old girl perspective is really good and refreshing and interesting. But in this book, in Among Others, Jo Walton is filtering school food and school uniforms and, like, no relationships for most of the book. Like, I got 60% of the way into this book. Yes, I'm reviewing it without finishing, but there's just no drama. There's nothing happening at the school. There's nothing. I mean, and if there is anything happening, it's explained over and over and over and just really, like I say, really plainly explained. Nothing is happening in the main story. Nothing at all. But, like, again, 60-65% in the way, there are things mentioned in the backstory, and there's things mentioned elsewhere. And I think, well, this could be it. And this is why I thought at the beginning of the book this was going to be great. It's like, yeah, and I did this thing with my twin, and there's, like, I've got an evil mother who tried, you know, did this, and I'm not sure what happened, you know. And I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. And 65% of the way into the book, I don't know anything that's happened. We're told over and over that the mother is in evil and insane and uses magic and things like that. But you're like, okay, an insane mother. When are we going to hear the stories of what she did? We're never told about what she did to be called insane. We're never told what she's actually like. We are told she is evil. We are told she is insane. We are told she is cruel. But we're never, none of those stories are ever recounted. We're told there was a car crash where the twin died. We're never told anything about the car crash. We're just told it happened. It's never described, ever. Nothing. 65% of the way in, all of the stuff which sounds even remotely interesting in the backstory hasn't happened 65% in the way in. And also, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. By the time we're 65% of the way in, the backstory has been withheld long enough that if it is revealed, it's revealing about what Maury would be like at the beginning of the book, at the beginning of a journal, not what she is like at the end. And we're coming to the end. This happened. I've complained about this in other books. One that comes up, a book which I actually quite enjoyed, called Market Forces by I was going to say Peter Hamilton. It wasn't Peter Hamilton. It's the Richard K. Morgan. And in there, one of my main complaints is that there's this mysterious thing that happened, and then it's kind of revealed slowly, and then the big payoff, the big reveal of what happened in the backstory is revealed right at the end of the book. And I'm like, but he isn't that person anymore. You're revealing now the reasons why he was like he was at the beginning of the book, not as he is at the end of the book, because all the way through we've had the main non-backstory, main story part, which has changed him so much that what happened in the immediate backstory isn't important anymore. And that's all I can think must be happening here, because it's not affecting the main story, and it's just being withheld. Why withhold the backstory? Why? Why fake keep it from us? And again, I've complained about this in books as well. Why have a character who knows every single thing about the backstory, why keep it from me as the reader? It doesn't make me more interested in it. It just makes me frustrated that every character knows everything that's happened up until this point, but it's being kept from me for no reason at all. So that's the overall problems with the structure and the story and actually what's happening. Nothing is happening. Fucking nothing is happening in this book as it goes through. Just boring details about a girl's life at school, which isn't interesting. And I'm not saying it's because it's a 15-year-old girl. I'm not saying it's because it's at a boarding school. I'm saying it's just badly written, badly plotted, massively repetitive. It keeps saying, like, I was actually getting angry where it says, oh, and I can't live with my auntie and my grandfather, even though they brought me up. Social services thinks I should live with my father, even though I never even met him in my life until a few months ago. I should have to live with him. I can't live with my grandfather and my auntie, even though they brought me up and even though I'm really good friends with them. I don't need to. And then, like, two chapters in, it's like, and now I really want to live, I'd really much prefer living with my auntie and my grandfather, but social services won't let me do it. It's like, I've heard this already, just a bit ago. Like, why, like, how come things like that haven't been edited out of this? It's just repetitive and boring. She takes a trip down to Wales and, like, nothing happens except a bit of magic, and then she comes back. And then next time she goes down to Wales, I'm like, what's going to happen here? Is she going to just meet the fairies again and still nothing happen? Well, maybe something will happen. There's a gate and she has to let a sister go or something. And you're thinking, well, okay, maybe the magic is interesting. What about the fantasy angle of this? And my note, my first response to that is, what about it? Like, it doesn't matter, and it doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't really impact what is happening. Because this is my note that I put, why does it feel like I'm listening to the delusional ramblings of a disturbed sufferer of post-traumatic stress syndrome or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Like, that's what it feels like to me. The magic rules could be interesting. They start off and I thought, oh, this could be interesting. Like, the fairies can't do anything. They can only ask me to do things. They can only ask other people to do things. And then, like, they can't interact directly with the world. But then if I interact directly with the world, I'm thinking, oh, this isn't making sense. So if someone interacts directly with the world, then the fairies have 100% control over the physical world. Causality being backwards, that they can reach back in time and change stuff to do things. And then maybe it's indistinguishable, like the magic is indistinguishable from reality, like things are going to happen anyway. And then I realized, oh, it's just like Christian prayer. You know, you pray a lot and then whatever happens anyway happens. And then you just go, oh, well, God willed this to happen. And if you pray and it doesn't happen, it's you didn't pray hard enough, or the magic didn't work, or the fairies aren't listening to me at the moment, you know. So, and we're told at the beginning that the magic may or may not exist, and all of the mentions of magic are couched in this hedging, couched in hedging? Is that right? There's a hedge made out of a couch. Everything is couched in terms which may or may not be real. And nobody but Maury herself can see or know anything that magic exists, and it's just, like, there's these massive long parts of the journal of her trying to convince herself that other people do believe in magic, but they don't say they believe in magic because they're afraid that she'll find out that they believe in magic, and it's like a conspiracy, and it's this weird conspiracy theory kind of thought processes where like every bit of evidence against your worldview turns into evidence for it by just saying, oh, that's actually the bad guys keeping the evidence from us, you know. It's a very well understood mindset. And I was just reading it going, like, why am I being subjected to... Like, this girl is probably... At the very least, she's delusional and suffering from PTSD. She probably has some kind of mental illness. You know, it's quite clear that her mother... Or, I say it's quite clear. She thinks that her own mother is insane and is some kind of mental illness and delusional. But she can't see it in herself. And I'm like, it's just uncomfortable to read. And she's, you know, there's some weird abuse kind of stuff, like obviously a history of abuse with her mother, and then her father is probably going to abuse her or tries to. And I'm just like, this is like, this girl needs help. This girl doesn't need to, she doesn't need to keep believing in fairies. If fairies are helping her get through stuff, that's fine. And I don't mind about people, you know, bad people getting better through, like if a bad person becomes a Christian and they become a better person because of it, great, they're now a better person because of it. And just because their belief is incorrect, it doesn't mean that the world is a net more benefit place for that one person believing Christianity. But there's lots of problems which need dealing with or need addressing, which won't be addressed if you believe in magic and magical thinking or prayer. I don't want to get into that kind of thing, but that's what it is. Now, this storyline of someone who is, you know, probably mentally ill, delusional, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, it can be interesting to read. For example, The Life of Pi. There is somebody who is in a bad situation and they have a delusion, and they have to have that delusion just for him to get through his traumatic experience and his difficult experience. He spins himself a story. And again, that's very clear. Like, is it just belief? What is the thing that matters most in that story? And of course, it comes down to his belief in that story was the most important thing for him. So he chooses to believe it. And we can also choose to believe it or not. You know, that's very clear. It's the same with Slaughterhouse-Five by Billy Pilgrim. And you're like, okay, he got through the firebombing of Dresden, suffering from massive post-traumatic stress disorder, and he tells himself lies. He creates a fantasy world for him to keep living in the world without going crazy and killing himself. It's, you know, he constructs an entire fantasy world for him. And that's interesting. These things are interesting, not because it's somebody creating a fantasy world for them, but it's in reaction to the firebombing of Dresden, or it's in, you know, it's to help him get through, you know, 15 months at sea with nothing to eat, and he creates a tiger for himself, a personification of his own, you know, he splits apart his own personality into different animals and lives with them, and the tiger is the one that survives longest and helps them get, you know, there's actually something going on. It's impacting the story in a way which is like, there's a meaningful story, there's a meaningful event, there's real drama, and then it plays throughout the whole book, or it informs the whole book. Now, Maury probably does have something traumatic. Losing a twin in a car accident probably is very traumatic, but what's it getting her through? It's getting her through quite a comfortable middle-class life going to boarding school. It's not helping her get through, like, the Hunger Games or Battle Royale or the firebombing of Dresden or being stranded at sea. There's not that extra level there, you know, and there's all these Philip K. Dick books as well, that the people, they create these weird fantasies for themselves. Again, that's a conspiracy, lots of conspiracy mindsets and fantasies and mindsets there. But it's just really inelegant and really inartful and just depressing and not very interesting. It could be very interesting, but when you have not very interesting drama filled with delusional, sad people who I only have pity for, combined with, most fatally, boringness, it doesn't get to me at all. So, you think that after mentioning Slaughterhouse-Five and Billy Pilgrim, there'd be something good to say about the thing which this is very well known for, and that is all the mentions of science fiction. How does all the mentions of science fiction, all the books that Maury is reading, she's an avid science fiction reader, like I say, she reads all of the science fiction books in the whole library, I read all of the science fiction books in my whole library, all of these, you know, all of these things in common, you know. How would this make me feel? Would I be nostalgic for this? And it makes me feel nothing. Because it's as fascinating as, you know, reading about how many buns Maury has bought for who. It's not fascinating at all. It's like most of the mentions of all the books, it's like, I bought this book, I read that book. I bought this book, I read that book. I bought this book, this person gave me this book, and I read it. This person gave me this book, and I read it. There is no impact on the wider story. There's not even any real discussion about any of these books. It's literally just, what I could do here is I could just open up the list of books that are mentioned in this this thing. Actually, I've got it here, because Tamahomi on Goodreads linked to it. So here's Jo Walton from her, you know, so Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Paul Anderson, The Broken Sword. You know, there's just a big list. What you could do is just read this big list and go, do I recognize any of these books? If so, tick yes. If no, tick no. There's only like maybe four or five of these books which have got any real impact. You know, she talks a little bit about Christianity. Oh, there's Narnia series. Narnia series mentioned a bit, and Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and Out of the Silent Planet, you know, those are mentioned a bit. She has this thing where she goes, I'm 15, I'm going through puberty, I have feelings for sexual feelings or anything like that. What do I think of sex? I think sex is like Robert A. Heinlein said, it's neither good nor bad, but it can be used for good or bad. But there's no, again, there's nothing artistic, there's no, it's just sort of like, I think this because of this. It's not saying anything at all about it. Like if we're not, she doesn't discover anything, and then anything is clarified to her by the book. It's just like, this is what the book says. I think this, and this is what the book says. There's no story. There's no drama that happens which is informed by the science fiction. 60% of the way through, no impact. Like, if you just say, okay, let's not call these science fiction books. Let's just replace them with fake science fiction books. None of these books actually exist. What does, to the story itself, no difference. Let's say they're not science fiction books. Let's say they're all fantasy books. How different would the overall plot be? No different. Let's say they're not science fiction or fantasy. Maybe they're just detective books. How much influence would it have over the entire story? No influence. Say they're all non-fiction books, they're all history books. How much influence? Nothing. You know, she joins a reading group, but the reading group doesn't have any interaction with her life. It's sort of like just, okay, she needs to interact with some people. There has to be a love interest comes along. So let's just make her get into a group. It doesn't even have to be a reading group. It could have been like a tennis group. It could have been anything. Just not impressed at all. And as I said, sometimes there are opinions expressed about the book, but it's utterly shallow. And I'm not just saying that because it's a 15-year-old girl. Like, if I was a 15-year-old boy, I probably wouldn't have very deep views or deep readings of these books at all. I don't want to insult something, but when it was just like, I read this book, it was brill. And then moving on, I was like, hey, when I was 13-year-old, when I was 15-year-old getting into science fiction, I could probably say more about science fiction, a book, than it was brill. You know, most books are mentioned once, she reads them, or she mentions that she has read them, or she mentions that she will read them, and they just disappear again. I need more than that. For example, this can be done with real art. It can be done with real interest, a way that really fascinates me. I'm talking about listing books or referencing science fiction books within science fiction. Like, for example, I made a list here. Terminal World is a really good example of a science fiction book about science fiction. You can just read the book, and it's just a book that's a steampunky, airship-based, fun, science fiction-y book. But you can also read it as it's in conversation with other science fiction novels or science fiction stories about Mars. That's what it is. Terminal World is Mars, and there's loads of stuff going on there. But it's, like I say, it's not blatant. It's not like, have you read this book? Say yay for yay, yay. Have you read this book? Boo, I haven't read this book. Do you like this book? No. Do you like this book by Stephen R. Donaldson? Boo, it's got a bad guy and boo. How about this book? No, that's boo. Or Halting State by, I think, Charles Stross. It's a great book, and there's loads of allusions and things, and it's like, again, it's in conversation. Same with Rainbow's End. It's kind of in conversation with cyberpunk, with other books about virtual realities and things. Hyperion and Cloud Atlas are another two books which kind of go together in that way, where it's talking, you know, it's using literature to talk about literature in a literary way. It's using the themes of these other books to talk about, or, you know, to like play with those themes in the book itself. Same with Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny. it's talk, it's using allusions and references to spiritual or religious works, let me put it that way, and spiritualism to talk about, you know, the human condition and what it would be like for men to be gods. You know, there's lots of stuff going on there. Don't just mention a list of books. There was a moment, like, she, Maury is saying, oh, I've read this book by Kurt Vonnegut and this book and this book. And I'm like, why doesn't she realize that she is Billy Pilgrim from Slaughterhouse-Five? Why doesn't she read one of these books and realize that is what she is in it? Like, why doesn't she look and say, oh, I'm at, maybe if I'm the only one who can see fairies and I'm the only one who believes all this exists, maybe I'm like Billy Pilgrim. Maybe I'm the one who is constructing a fantasy world for myself to live in. You know, maybe like Billy Pilgrim doesn't actually get abducted by aliens. Maybe I'm not seeing fairies. But there isn't anything like that in. And what have we put down here in my next note? Worst part, yeah. Why does she like science fiction? 65% of the way in, don't know. When the book starts, like in that first section, she makes a reference to Mordor, makes a reference to, you know, Lord of the Rings. And then she's just like, oh, and I met up with my father, and he had lots of science fiction books in his shelf, so I decided to pick out all the ones I haven't read and take them with me to boarding school. And I'm like, oh, so you're already into science fiction. And I think, well, when do we get to learn why she likes science fiction, why it means so much to her, and why she just reads it all voraciously? That would have been really handy to know that at the beginning, before she lists hundreds of books that she's read and all of these dozens of books that she's going to read and that she's discussing with the science fiction book club group at the library, you know, all of that kind of stuff. If you just told me what was the first science fiction book she read? When did she start reading? And I know it kind of mentioned, oh, she read The Hobbit, and she was like, oh, there's another one with the hobbits in it, isn't it? What's it called? Lord of the Rings. I'll read that one. You know, it's kind of hinted at, but nothing is there. Like, and I was just thinking, if she can read that many books that quickly, how come there are any books that she's not read yet? Like, if she, like, it's one of those things that if she's 15 and she started reading science fiction books when she was 8, how can there be any that she's not read yet? And there seems to be all these series and stuff. It's like, how does she only discover interlibrary loans when she's 15? Like, if she's that into science fiction, either she couldn't have read that much, she can't be that much into science fiction, or she's read all science fiction by now. So, yeah. And reading about somebody, like I say, I read all of the science fiction books in my library when I was young, but guess what? Not very interesting. I don't think that was interesting for me, and it probably happened. So anyway, I got 65% of the way through, and then I was thinking, well, can I spend another 3.5 hours on this book? And I realized, no. Because I realized it was boring me so much. It was sending me to sleep. I put it on. And I thought, well, if I stop listening to this and, like, listen to a podcast or start another audiobook, will I ever return to this book? Has anything happened 65% of the way in, which makes me think I'm going to get something new before the end? And I thought, no. So it's one of those times I go, well, I guess what happens next is that, you know, I'd say, oh, I don't want to spoil it, but there's nothing to spoil. She's just buying books, reading them, having delusions about her mother. And I'm thinking, well, by the end, she's probably going to have a confrontation with her mother. She's probably going to, you know, kiss a boy or have something like that. And then maybe the boy will confirm her delusions by also seeing the fairies. And so I checked out Wikipedia, and near enough, spot on. I was like, good, I just saved myself listening to another 3 hours of boring life of the most boring person in the world, written in the most boring way possible, having no opinions on books except it's Brill or I think sex is good, maybe. Which brings me to the end of the review. I mean, I could say more about what happens and stuff, but it's just not sure. I didn't want this to be a whole rant about it, but like everything in this book could be perfect for me. You know, all of these elements could be good, and it's just written in the most boring way ever. And I'm thinking, well, how did this win the Hugo Award? How did it win the Nebula Award? It's obvious. It's a pure nostalgia hit. It's everybody, all of these authors now, who I think it's the authors vote for the Nebula Awards, they're just going, oh yeah, in the 1970s, I read all of these books as well. So I will vote for it, because it mentions lots of books that I read. And it's one of those things that it can't be that obvious. How can a book which is so badly written and so boring, actually, individual sentences aren't written badly, but when you have the same sentence written 4 times over in 4 different chapters about the same topic with the same reaction, like, how can this be a novel which people think is good? It, sure, read a list of books that you like and let those that list of books that you like remind you how much you like those books. Great. No problem about that. But wrapping up in a novel about a sad, abused young girl who does nothing with her life and who's perfect in every way. Like, she's not perfect in every way. She's not very good at maths. Everything else she's great at. You know, it's she used to be the best runner, the fastest runner, and she's the best in all these grades. She's the best at this, best at that. The only person better than her at French is someone whose mother is French and she can speak French better. It's like, why read about someone who is just like perfect yet damaged in perfect in the most boring way and damaged in one of the most boring ways, doing the most boring stuff ever? So yeah, I guess that's the only reason it could have won. It's like, hey, Hugo voters, remember all these books which also won Hugo's? I will now list them for you and talk about one of them in depth from the point of view of a delusional 15-year-old. Ta-da! Give me a Hugo, please. Thank you. It feels very... yeah, I don't know. Feels very strange to read something like that. It's not good. It's not science... First of all, it's nowhere near science fiction. It's not even trying to be science fiction. It's just a 15-year-old girl's school diary who, and there are mentions of magic, some magic realism, but it's not even very good. It's not even very good magic. It's not even good. It's somebody who's made up some magic which is indistinguishable from reality, except through the views of a young girl who's got post-traumatic stress from her twin dying in a car accident. So yeah. So I'm gonna give it. I was gonna say. Well, I didn't finish it. So like, how many stars can I give a book that I didn't finish? But like, I definitely got enough to review it. And there was a section at the beginning which had so much promise. And I can't give it even one star for that section because that section only lasted about 7 minutes of the audio. And then I listened to, like, how long is the audiobook in total? Let me look it up here. I have it right here on Audible. Yeah, 10 hours. So I listened to, like, another... I had 6 minutes of thinking this was an amazing book and then 6 hours of thinking it was a terrible book. It's almost 11 hours long in total. And I just can't recommend it. I can't rate it highly. So I think I'm going to give it 0.5 stars out of 5, which means, for me, this is based purely on my own personal enjoyment of it. And it kind of, it's one of those books which, like I say, all the ingredients could have been there, and it's just so disappointing. This book was so great for so many people. Obviously, loads of people really love this book, and it touches them in many ways. But for me, it was a flop on every single level, and it was like the extra disappointment in that. So 0.5 stars, which is one of the lowest things. Normally I wouldn't review a book if I didn't finish it. Normally if I get to part of the way through a book and I don't finish it, but I thought I got so far into this one, 6 hours into it, that six and a half hours into it, I feel okay about rating a book so low, even though I didn't finish it, which I think people can understand why I didn't. So that's it for me. You can check out... Oh, let me just put this. I do think Kathleen Kellgren's narration is really good, though. Like I say, that is one thing that could have saved the book, which actually was a thing that kind of tricked me into enjoying it for so long, because it's such a great, like, light voice. This is such a really great narration, but it's wasted. It's like, how many times can I hear someone say, "It's Brill!" And, you know, by the fourth time she says a book is Brill, or meeting someone was Brill, or someone was so great and stuff. It's just, it's just wasted on the narrator. Anyway, I do suggest you go check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP for a free audiobook. I can't recommend this one, but you can always check out Dream Snake, which I reviewed last time out and quite enjoyed. And there's an example of a bad audiobook, not narration, but the production of that was spoiling my enjoyment of a book. But in the end, the book won me over, and I got through to the end and really enjoyed it. And this one, where the narration is fantastic, turns out a fantastic narration can't save one of the most boring, ineffectual books I've ever read. So, yeah, but anyway, audibletrial.com/SFBRP. You can start your own free trial. You get a free trial of Audible, which is an audiobook subscription service. There's 200,000 audiobooks on there to check out. I suggest getting over there. You can go to sfbrp.com. and check out some good books to get from Audible. The way you do it is go to sfbrp.com, click on, there's an episode lists link at the top, and when you go on there, there's a big list, and I've rejiggered it around, so you can now sort the list by episode number, by author, by book, by rating, by the length of the episode, or by the size of the MP3 file, for No reason, that last one, but there you go. So check out some highly rated books there. Check out some highly rated authors and get yourself a free audiobook from audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And in that way, you help out me and my own book purchasing habits and things like that by monetarily. So thanks a lot for helping support the SFBRP. And what else? Yeah, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. Check out goodreads.com. You can become my friend on there and see my reading progress. And I can also see how highly you rate this book. This is reviewed 3.8 average by SFBRP listeners. 3.6. But I do think, actually, Tamahomi mentioned on Goodreads, he says, this is very much a Marmite book. You will love it or hate it. Oh, they did it on a they did it as a sword and laser book. No, it wasn't Tamahomi. It was Terp Kristin, who you may also recognize from SFF audio podcasts and things. This is a total Marmite book in sword and laser. It'll be interesting to see what you think of it, given your familiarity with many of the books mentioned and discussed. Generally speaking, those with more familiarity with these books and the genre liked it more. For me, I'm very familiar with almost all of the books that I mentioned, or at least all of the authors mentioned, even if I haven't read all of the books by all of the authors. And it was the familiarity with them which made me realize the lost potential in all of these mentions. All of them could have been put in a lot more artistically. So anyway, that's it from me. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I reply to every single email I get, unless you're an author and you want me to read your book or your publisher and or something like that. I will not read your book. Please don't email me about it. So thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.